The practice of austerity and penance is meant for understanding the distinction between the body and the soul, and how the soul can be unaffected by the pleasures and pains of the body. Shakyamuni was actually situated on the platform of self-realization. He was completely aloof from the bodily conception. Therefore, he immediately took this position and convinced the king that whatever contradictory things the king has said about his body did not actually apply to him as a spirit soul. So here we begin the response of Jarabara to the chastisement of King Rahula. And of course, what did the king do? He chastised Jarabara for his the manner in which he carried his palaka. Sarcastic words. In his response, Jarabara is somewhat agreeing with the statements of the king, but in a more philosophical way. And his strategy is to show that actually, though the king is addressing Jarabara as a body who may be strong or whatever, or clumsy or dull-minded or whatever, and slow, fact is that we're not a body at all. Everybody is a jiva, a soul. And we see from Bhagavad Gita, from the characteristics of the soul, have nothing to do with the characteristics of the body. That's so big or small, or fat or thin, etc. Don't apply to the soul at all. Of course, the soul cannot be affected by anything in this world. So therefore, in the second chapter, Krishna says, you cannot burn, you cannot cut, you cannot drown, you cannot dry out, you cannot do anything with the soul in terms of material afflictions. So you can't use a knife or an earthly object to crush the soul or hurt it at all. You cannot wet it, you cannot drown it, you cannot use water to disturb the soul. You cannot use fire, you cannot burn it anyway. The wind, you cannot dry it out with the wind and blow it away, whatever. So the material elements have no effect on the soul at all. Whatever we think of is affecting us, only affecting the body. But true, as long as we identify with the body through ahankara and ignorance, then we will think, yes, the knife is cutting me, or the fire is burning me, or the water is drowning me, etc. And so we will think that the material elements are affecting us when we have this false identity. So this false identity is not some fantastic thing, because we see it operates all the time. We can understand how it works very nicely. If you have a dream, and then you identify with the dream, and then you think, I'm going to have this happening in a dream, you wake up and say, it wasn't true. But as long as you're in the dream, you're identifying with that dream body, and whatever happens to it. And so the tiger chases you in the dream, then you get afraid, you start running away, and then you wake up, so it's in a dream. So you come out of that illusion, but while you're in, you're identifying very much with that particular body. So that's the same with the body we have as soon as we're born. We're identifying with this body, and then it goes on until we die. Nevertheless, it's not true, but we don't wake up. That's the thing. So we wake up from a dream, but we do not wake up from the material world. It's very, very difficult to wake up. Another example is a drama. In ancient times, they had dramas. And as long as the drama is going on, you identify with the characters in the drama, and particularly the hero. And if the hero gets hurt, then you feel hurt. And if the hero is victorious, you feel victorious. If the hero falls in love, then you fall in love. So you identify with the characters very much. And that's the same as we have in movies. You identify with the hero in the movie, and whatever she does, you identify with it. And that lasts as long as the movie lasts. When the movie ends, it's all right. And you walk out and you're back normal again. But you're identified with that. So that's what happens in the material world, with the material body, to identify everything here. But actually, it's not us, because we're actually up. So it's easy to get out of these temporary feelings of dreams or dramas or movies or whatever, because they're very temporary, and then you walk out of it and you're back to normal again. But this identity with the material body is very difficult to get out of. Once we're stuck in the body, we identify with it very strongly because we have this ahamkara, the subtle body attached to us. So then we identify very strongly with our material body from the time we're in the womb. And then it lasts until we die. When we die, and then when people are leaving their body, then they get a deep like, I'm not the body. We have near-death experiences, and the people understand that I'm not the body. They're looking at the body that I'm different from my body. So they come back to their body. So they get a temporary realization out of where it's all false identity. And in fact, the people that have these experiences often, because of that experience of understanding they're not the body, when they come back, they're completely different. They no longer involve themselves in all of the material pleasures, etc. They're more philosophical, more detached. And they understand that they're not really the body and they happen that level. That's, of course, something that's beneficial for them. And the other way, of course, is simply by reading scriptures, you understand the body. That's chapter 2. But it doesn't register. That fact does not register unless we have faith. So if you don't have faith in the Bible, you can even read the whole thing, and you still you think you're in your body. If you have faith, when you read the Bible, you think the Christians are not the body or the soul. The soul is eternal. It's not cut, it's not burned, it's not dried up. What do you say? Okay, I accept that. So we get a little realization if we have faith and we accept the scriptures. Still, we're not fixed in that realization. So therefore, we do have to ultimately develop a fixed realization that we are the soul, and then we get liberated from the material world. But that's a very, very difficult thing to do. As we see with the Gandhis and Yogis, to get out of that material conception is very, very difficult. So, in general, difficult because we are conditioned. Again, of course, in Sanskrit, we're in bondage. We're bandha. We're bound up. But Prabhupada often uses the word conditioned, which is a good word because it means that we're habituated to it. And because of that habituation, we cannot change it. So it's an automatic response as long as we're under demons, we're unharmed, that will identify with the material body, when we try to enjoy the material world, we'll suffer happiness and stress, we'll get karma, and go from body to body to body. So that's the result of our bondage and our conditioning. And so once you're conditioned, it's difficult to get out of that conditioning. And that is why, even in one lifetime, it is difficult to get out of your conditioning. Everybody is conditioned by their body. They get out of their body, I'm this body, whatever. I got this characteristic, I act like this, and this is how I respond, and I can't do anything else. So that's our conditioning. And it's very difficult to change. And so that is why people in this world, they keep on repeating the same mistakes and acting in the same way, even though it's not really beneficial for them. Because they're conditioned, and then they can't get out of the conditions and suck that thing. Once they get a bad habit, they cannot change a bad habit, so to speak. A person who's, of course, you can develop a bad habit also, as intoxication, drinking, alcoholism, and then it's difficult to get out of it. That's another type of conditioning. That conditioning arises because chemicals go into your body and they affect your nervous system and your brain. And they say, oh, this is nice. this pleasure, this control. And then when you don't have that, you feel, oh, this is not good, I want to get that again. So then you go drink again and get the pleasure again, or the drug or whatever. So you get conditioned to that experience. Oh, this is nice, this is nice. This is this chemical operating in your brain. So, imposed conditioning, an addiction. So then the greater our conditioning is, we're really attached to the material body. And we're stuck in the material body, we're doing that. The psychologists sometimes say that your personality is molded in the first few months of your life, when you come out of the womb. And whatever happens in those first few months, that will determine your how you respond to the world the rest of your life. So in other words, all of your conditioning is put on you when you're one or 2 months old and it's coming out of your mother. And then everything else is, you react to that conditioning. You work in terms of that condition the rest of your life. That's difficult to take. Which is why when children are born, they have to be treated very carefully. And which is why they don't even let the child go in the house for 1 month, technically after they're born, according to New Vedic tradition. And then they have a ceremony of the Mishram, where they go over to the house for the first time after 1 month. And for that, nobody can see the child, and you know, protect the child. So, of course, modern psychology, it's only, you know, 2 months or 3 months or whatever it is, the mold of character. But in a lot of sense, it's true. But then we know, of course, everyone, another life before that condition, another life before that. So those conditions are also pushing us, not just the first 3 months of our life, this life. We've got all these other conditions from previous life that are pushing us also. So very difficult to escape all of this conditioning in the material world. And that's why it's difficult for people to change. Once they develop from childhood, it's very difficult to change the way they act and whatever the rest of their life. It's possible, but difficult. Possible, but difficult. That is the challenge for our spiritual life, because of all that conditioned life after life, very difficult to carry that ahankara. Everything falls after that. All the impressions, all the karmas, all the ahankara, all stuck in the subtle body. Very difficult to carry that. That's a big challenge. But it is possible if one endeavors. If we make an attempt, then look, we can do something. And that is why Krishna says, Abhyasa Nirmonya, Vairagyam Chaturthite. Difficult to control the mind, but if you practice and you detach yourself from things, certain things you don't do, you avoid certain things, then you can control the mind. So it's possible, but it requires practice and attachment. And to do that, it requires some determination and some intelligence. That is why pursuing spiritual life is a little rare in this world, because not many people have that determination and intelligence to follow a process like that. If we follow the traditional processes, then naturally, if you progress through the gunas, then gradually you become detached, and you develop control of the mind and control of the senses. So we see there the characteristics of the Brahmana. What is one characteristic? Sama. Another is Dhamma. Control of the mind, control of the senses. These are natural characteristics of the Brahmana who is in Sattva-guna. So if you're in Sattva-guna, then naturally you control your mind and your senses. Easy. If you're in Tamaguna, difficult. Can't do it. And therefore, it's difficult for the people in Tamaguna and Rajaguna to really advance spiritually. Those in Sattva-guna, yes, easier for them. So that's why we have a modern ashram system to gradually elevate people upwards from people who are rather hopeless at the bottom. Gradually they get trained up in a very, very slow, gradual manner, birth after birth, until they get to Sattva. Then they move quickly. The gunas of material nature themselves have been arranged by the Lord to help us spiritually. So that within the gunas, that sattva-gun, we got a little hope here of the material world, an escape hole, so to speak. Within sattva-gun itself, there's a way to get out of the material world. Otherwise, it's impossible. You can't do it. And people only want it because there's so much ignorance. So they're in prison, and they don't think there's anything else except the prison, so they don't want to get out. So they just adapt to the prison, that's the conditioning. And if it's tough with them in prison, then they're in small little dark holes and miserable, etc. And whatever, they have to work very hard. And it's okay, that's life. As long as they get the food and they get a place to sleep. Okay, fine. They tolerate the situation, that's the conditioning. And then we get a bigger device, bigger activity, more thing. And they say, well, this is very nice, aren't you? Or if it's a sattva, then of course, they get more luxury, but more comforts, etc. like that. And they say, that's very nice. It's all conditioning. It's all within the person. But if it's sattva, then there is a way of getting out. There's a little crap hole. We'll see the glory you get out of that. This is the material world. Everyone is bound up and in general difficult to get out. And the varnashram system helps us. And then once you get the sattva-gun, you can practice jnana and yoga. And if you do that properly, then you get out of the prison. That is liberation. But those two processes are also difficult. Krishna also provides another process, that is bhakti yoga. So this process is a little different from the other processes. It doesn't require gradual elevation to the gunas, but you can still do that. Of course, you do elevate, but you elevate not through varnashram, you elevate through bhakti. So bhakti is a way of getting out of the prison in a more direct way. Not having to go up to the different levels of the person until you get to the sattva level and you get the whole get out. You can just get out from any level by practicing bhakti. The process of bhakti is very quickly destroys this whole conditioning, which is said arises from ahankara and ignorance. So the process of bhakti destroys that. This, of course, is stated in the Nectar Devotion, where Rupa Goswami explains that the suffering of the material world is caused by karmas. Karmas are caused by actions. Actions are caused by desires. Desires are caused by ignorance. So all of these things are destroyed by bhakti. The ignorance, the desires, and the karmas are all destroyed by the process of bhakti. So the very root is the ignorance, and that gets destroyed also. And all the byproducts of that, the desires, the karmas, the suffering, etc., all destroyed by the process of bhakti. So that does not require you come to sattva when you start. So that's why you're at the bottom in Tamil Nadu, you can still do it. If you have that faith, which means that you have that acceptance. That we're not the body, the soul, and that there's three more also. And then the determination to get to that goal, then we begin to practice. Whether we're something going around you more, come to it. So that is how we can defeat this problem we have here, being stuck in the material world and identifying with the material body, etc. We destroy all these concepts by. The process of bhakti yoga. So bhakti yoga becomes easier because the goal, that is the destruction of all the karmas, understanding your atma, understanding, realizing the Supreme Lord, looks very far off. From the beginning of devotional service itself, we get an inspiration or higher taste. And that is the Shakti Bhakti itself, that it gives us some satisfaction. The practice of Bhakti itself gives satisfaction to the jiva. And though we don't get any realization, we get some higher taste, some higher satisfaction, and this inspires us to go further and further and further in the process of bhakti until we get the redemption. Any questions?
What specific activities of bhakti can assimilate that purification of the ignorance and the...
Which particular, any activity of bhakti actually does this. If we look in their devotion, then Rupa Goswami says, bhakti has some special characteristics, six characteristics, and the first characteristic is klesha, destruction of suffering. And what is suffering? It is ignorance, it is desires, it is karmas. And all of these get destroyed by the process of bhakti, starting with the beginning of sadhana bhakti. So, sadhana bhakti does this. So, and then gives the types of sadhana bhakti you can do. So, you have 64 types of emotional service, hearing, chanting, reading, worship, associated with devotees, living in the Dham, offering obeisances, putting on tilak, all these destroy your karmas and destroy your ignorance. So just putting on tilak destroys your ignorance and your karmas. Of course, the most powerful one is chanting the name of Krishna, which is illustrated in the case of Ajahn. He was not even doing bhakti, no faith, but also no operas, but no faith. And simply by chanting once the name Narayan, to name his son, all those karmas got destroyed. So therefore bhakti is very powerful to become great effects in destruction of all karmas of chanting once the name of Narayan. So if we chant with faith, of course we get much more effect. But we have to avoid the aparas or offenses. So, of course, it's usually a gradual affair. So we destroy our karmas. And then to destroy the desires, it takes a little more time. And to destroy the ahankara, it takes more time. So usually the ahankara gets destroyed in the bhava stage. And so that's where the avidya goes. And then the devotee feels that liberation is nothing because it's gone beyond liberation itself in the bhava stage. For the destruction of the demons takes longer to accomplish. But any process of bhakti can do that. Offering respects to the deity, offering prayers, taking prasadam, destroy other karmas, destroy your desires, etc.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, in a previous class you had said that bhakti is about the gunas.
Yeah.
So, my question is, does it lead to
Sattva-guna
in terms of
bhakti? If it's about the
guna? Practicing bhakti, yeah. Practicing bhakti will automatically get
one to Sattva-guna. Well, beyond Sattva-guna. So, bhakti is by nature nirguna because it's part of Krishna's internal energy, which is beyond gunas. So it's the essence of Krishna's spiritual energy. So it's beyond the gunas or nirguna. It manifests in this world, and it may look like it's in the gunas because you can have tamagun bhakti, rajagun bhakti, or sattvagun bhakti. That's the contamination of the mind. It's not the bhakti itself. By performing bhakti, particularly pure bhakti, but then if from tamagun we can rise up through sattvagun, but we surpass it. We surpass all the gunas. Through the process of bhakti. So we're not trying to attain sattva guna because that's also a kind of bondage in the material world. If you only look for sattva guna, then you may end up trying to get liberation. So again, impersonal mukti is maybe a characteristic of sattva guna. So then we won't go for bhakti. So we avoid sattva guna also, getting too attached to sattva guna.
So basically, if one is ignorant, then natural progression is passion, goodness, and then about.
Yeah.
Thank you. Maharaj, can you clarify the last 2 lines, the translation of the last line? It says that if the object of the journey and the path leading there were mine, there would be many troubles for me. But because they led not to me but to my body, there is no trouble at all.
In this particular case, we have Raghuna getting on a path when people carry it on a path because he wants to go in a particular place. And if you're going too slow and you're like, this, you know, how to get there. So this is the material destination that we determine. And I think this is mine, this is where I want to go, etc. And this is how I'm going to get there, that's the path. So we have a process and a goal in mind, a material process and a material goal. A path or a road with a path going on it, and then object of a journey, maybe he wants to go to the next town or something like that. So, then this is our attachment. We have a certain goal in mind with all of our actions. And then we get to the material world, we get obstacles to that, and then we feel disturbed. In this case, the disturbance is Jambara, not carrying the palanquin properly, and it came out of here, and I'm getting all, you know, bumps in my journey. So then he gets disturbed. But if you understand that this is a superficial material goal for a material purpose, and you understand that we're actually a spirit soul beyond the material world, then we'll not be disturbed by all the obstructions that come on the path.
Trying to understand that aspect of practical application of bhakti as an activity and that involves the use of elements and also the awareness of the environment for the effectiveness of the purpose, because we want to achieve some kind of service, for example. To be aware of that, the utility of the elements, material in one sense, and material because that is spiritual. It would be, for example, like in this case, the text explained those goals are not mine because it's not related to me. It's a spiritual soul, that is more material.
Yes.
That awareness, how we can reconcile those points.
Yeah, so the definition of sadhana bhakti is to engage the senses of mind. And the senses are generally considered to be material. And when we engage the senses, we end up with karma. That's the normal thing. But when we use the senses in a certain way, that is, anukulina krishna vasulanam, and anyabhalasha shunya, then opposite, we destroy karma. So the senses don't give a material result if we use them in bhakti, which means we engage our senses for giving happiness to Krishna. That's anukulina krishna vasulanam. With no other desires, then it doesn't give a material effect at all, even though we're engaging the senses. Yeah. And we can engage objects. We offer a flower, we cook rice to offer to the deity, even though it is so-called material, because we're engaging in Krishna service and offering to his pleasure, then it loses its material qualities. And when we enjoy it, as we eat the rice and it's prasadam, we get spiritual result, not material result. So it's very interesting that the internal energy of Krishna, that bhakti, when it fuses our actions of the senses, and then the objects and the senses connected with it are no longer material, but they have spiritual effect. So that's the power of bhakti itself. But that depends on the intention of the person. It's not just the engagement. You can offer to Krishna without devotion, then it's not the effect. The Krishna person said that. So we have to have that intention of trying to please Krishna. And then all these actions do have great power in them, and they take us out of, they destroy all the karmas, etc. And not only destroy karmas, but the atma develops more and more attraction for Krishna, more and more love for.
Can we understand the cultivation of that intention is gradual?
Yeah. Yeah. The seed is strong power of faith. And when it turns into an action, we actually do something, then it becomes bhakti. But in the beginning, of course, it is the intention of these Krishnas are little, because the faith is very little. And as the attraction for Krishna grows in the jiva, and then the bhakti increases, and then the effort increases, and becomes more powerful as you progress in bhakti.
It's difficult to understand that only in the first 3 months of childhood that the conditioning takes place, because we have the swabhava and prabhava. Swabhava is in the previous
life. Well, that's what I'm saying. This is modern science. The modern psychology. Obviously, in the womb also, but they say the first 6 months or something, the first 5 months, which indicates that this is in the months of good, that you have to take care of your children when they're very, very young and protect them very nicely, take care of all their needs, and then they'll feel satisfied. And if you don't do that, then they have they become enemies of this world, and think the world is persecuting me and this and that. They start fighting with everybody, and they can't control themselves when they're grown up because they're so hostile. And that hostility came when they're small, 1 month old, 2 months old, they develop this hostility to their mother and father and everybody else in the world because nobody treated them properly. So that's basically that. But of course, we have previous lifetime, many previous lifetimes, influences also there.
Now, Marek, I behave in a particular way, condition, because of what has been written in my mind, the previous samskara, impressions I'm carrying. Now, by using my intelligence, can I override on those impressions? I gave no instructions by the intelligence to the mind.
Yes.
Can override on them.
Yes. So if we have intelligence and determination, and then by practice, we change the habit. We can develop a new habit to replace an old habit. So that's why we practice something, we become good at it. And that's why in children, you go to school, why? So they can practice writing the letters, A, B, C. So this is their, you're putting something into them, it's already there. You're creating a new habit, and then it's stuck there for the rest of their life. Yeah? Then you can replace that with another language later on, and learn another language, so you can increase in that way. Yeah? So that's how you can change. Yeah? But some things are so ingrained, it's very difficult to change. Those things that are stuck in on your 2 months old or 3 months old, those things can be very difficult to change in some cases. So that's why it's difficult to train some children. They refuse to go to school, they refuse to learn, they refuse to follow their parents because something happened when they're very, very young, and then they're hostile to everybody. So they want to learn anything like that. They have a completely different idea of the world.
Maharaj, in the process of understanding that we are not the body, utilizing the subtle energies can be conducive for that aim?
Well, what does subtle energy mean? That means the subtle body, actually.
Yeah.
And in the subtle body, we do have all of our karmas, our previous desires, etc. And then, as I said, you can also put inputs into there, by the new thoughts into there, or new feelings into there. And so we can influence that subtle body by different things. Just as you can influence the gross body by different types of food. Sattva food, Rajagun food, Tamagun food, or Sattva music, Rajagun music, Tamagun music affect the body. They also they affect the subtle body. So many things affect the subtle body. So you can, by changing the gunas of things, you can start changing your subtle body as well as your gross body. So that means they're effective to also start changing your mind a little bit and make it more subtle, and then you give up certain toxic habits or whatever by subtle influence on the subtle body. So many different things can help with food, environment, people, colors, music, all sorts of things. That, of course, is material. But then we have the spiritual individuals also. So the devotees themselves have spiritual shakti. So this is nirvana influence, or kirtan, or seeing the deity. This is all the spiritual thing, which kind of purifies the whole subtle body, gets rid of all the bad things, and creates spiritual right there, which destroys all the negative things.
Maharaj, primarily we are all Krishna says in 14th chapter, Madhya Tishtati Rajasara. Primarily on this planet, the overarching layer is mode of passion. Within that passion, maybe somebody is in mode of goodness, somebody is in mode of passion, somebody is in mode of
goodness. Yeah, so we're the middle earth, so to speak, middle place. So this is passion, and then you go above that, the Sarga Loka, and then the Sattva, you go below that, and it's Tamasic down to the lower planetary system. So that's the general. And then within that, then we get grades also. And then Varshas and different Vipas also. And in those Vipas, they're more Sattvic. In those Varshas, they're more Sattvic. It's like Bhoma Sarga, that is heavily planted on Earth. So if you go to Kim Purusha Varsha or Ari Varsha or Kuru Varsha or Zana Varsha, Yalakuta Varsha, then basically it's more Sattvic. And we come to Bharat Varsha, this is where we get Varnashram, we get, you know, Sudras, Vashishakshas, Brahmanas, and then like this. So a mixture there. But basically, we say Rajagun. And if you're Rajagun, you can get born back on Earth.
Maharaj, in the first canto, in the realizations of Narada Muni, and after he got his mother passed, and he was more dedicated to wandering and practice austerities, he was more into both of goodness. And he got the vision of Vishnu, of Paramatma, but then Paramatma disappeared and said, because you are more into attached to the mode of goodness, for that reason you won't be able to realize the mode of seeing again. Is that the understanding?
Well, no, the story of Narada Muni is tracing the progress of bhakti from Shraddha to Vajra Kriya, Anarjana, Vritti, Nishta, Ruchi, Asati, Bhava, and Prema. So it's all bhakti actually. So his initial faith was caused by association with the devotees and taking their prasada brahmanas, and then he developed faith and then began to hear from them. So Vajra Kriya, and gradually his gunas dissipated, Anarjana, Vritti, Nishta, and then Ruchi, Asati, Sudhi, hearing, process, Shravana, and hearing. And at a certain point in Bhava, I suppose, then he had a vision of the Lord, and the Lord spoke to him, but then the Lord said, I'm not going to appear to you in his lifetime, you can't get pure. And so his longing for the Lord created more purification, and then he got pregnant at the end of his life. So basically, it's the progress of bhakti. Okay, Hare Krishna.